Okay, thanks. So I'll be talking about several projects today that, several projects that have been headed up by a group of undergrads, grad students, postdocs, artists, professors, all working together at UT in collaboration with some at UCSF as well. We started, the first project I'll talk about, bacterial edge detector, was actually started at the first iGEM and proposed by us, our group at UT and UCSF, and we've actually continued through and followed it up for subsequent years, and so I'll talk about that a little bit now. So our idea was, rather than try to encode some very complex machine-like behavior into bacteria and fight an uphill battle and make them do something they don't necessarily aren't very good at doing, we decided to sort of take advantage of some aspects that biological systems offer you computationally. And the first one that came to mind was massive parallelism. And so we thought if we could encode a simple logical computation into a single bacterial cell and then grow a population of these cells and make them work together to compute some more complex problem, that we may actually be able to sort of solve an interesting problem in a unique fashion. And so the first thing that came to mind was edge detection. And edge detection is basically the solution of the light-dark boundary of an image. And so you can see if we projected an image onto a petri dish, the light areas, there would be light areas, there would be dark areas. This would be covered in bacteria, and we would ask the bacteria to actually compute the light-dark boundary. And the way we would do this is to have the bacteria in the dark recognize that they're in the dark, and send out some diffusible molecule to all their neighbors. And if their neighbors were in the dark, they would be immune to this diffusible molecule. If their neighbors were in the light, they would be susceptible to this diffusible molecule. And if they're in the light, they could be activated by it. And so if you're in the dark, you're inactive. If you're in the light and near the dark, you would be active. And if you're in the light and far away from the dark, you would also be inactive. So here's just sort of a demonstration. Shine an image, take it away, and you're left with the edge of that image. So there are three steps. So this is non-trivial. There are three steps to engineering this in a system, a tractable system like E. coli. The first was engineering sight into E. coli, which can't naturally see light, which was non-trivial. The second was to use sight to spatially control gene expression over a two-dimensional bacterial surface. And the third would be once the bacteria can see an image and reproduce it and decide whether they're in the light and the dark, to actually ask them to compute the light-dark boundary of the captured image. So the first step was engineering sight into E. coli. And this we reported on in the first iGEM. This work was done in the Voigt lab at UCSF. And what they basically did was take a light-sensitive protein from cyanobacteria, fuse it to a homologous salt-responsive protein from E. coli, which controls gene expression in E. coli, such that they could actually use light to inhibit the expression of a gene in E. coli. And so what we wanted to do, and so here's the data, you see that when the cells were grown in the dark, they had high gene expression from some reporter gene, and when they were grown in the light, that was significantly repressed. So for the purposes of the edge detector, what we wanted to do was just black box this behavior, say we've got this nice new regulatory mechanism. We want to black box it and say that red light inverts the expression of some gene. Okay. So now the second step was to actually resolve an image. So to lay out the bacteria in massively parallel fashion, ask them, project an image of light onto them, and ask them to actually capture or recreate that image. And so using that light sensor that we developed, we actually built a sort of unique light projection system. This was done by an undergraduate, Aaron Chevalier, at UT. And basically what we did is use a strong light source, filter it into the red bands where the light sensor was maximally responsive, and then use a 35 millimeter slide like this as a stencil, and then focus that image down into a 37 degree incubator where the bacteria could grow and project a focus image on them. And so if we project an image like this, we can get a nice high resolution recreation of that image. So that was good. We had two of the steps accomplished, and we reported that. We made sort of big improvements on our ability to resolve high resolution images last year. And so now we wanted to use the system to encode an edge detection algorithm into the E. coli, and actually ask them to compute the light-dark boundary of Drew's face instead of just recreating Drew's face, right? So you'd see the outline instead of just a positive recreation of it. And so what we did was, again, black box the light detector. So we have light repressing the expression of a couple genes. And the edge detection logic is actually pretty simple. So you have You have light repressing the expression of LuxI, which is a gene which makes the diffusible activator homoserine lactone, which activates transcription of a reporter gene. But simultaneously, light's repressing the expression of a dominant repressor, lambda C1, which dominantly represses the expression of that reporter gene even in the presence of the activator. And so because this promoter is actually engineered by Ron Weiss some years ago, but the logic is such that it's active in the presence of the activator only in the absence of the inhibitor. And so this logic should only occur at the light-dark boundary. So we actually built the system, and we projected just a simple edge right down the middle of a bacterial plate. So this is the image. We have light on one side, dark on the other side. Here's the photography strain that we showed you before, the control. In the light, it's off. In the dark, it's on, as before, as would be expected. And we grew the edge detector. It was completely blank, completely off. So it was dominantly repressed. So we thought this is not completely sort of unpredictable. It sort of made sense because we knew that the light repressed promoter wasn't completely repressed. You'll notice that in the light there's a significant amount of expression of the gene off that promoter. So being that the gene expressed off that promoter here was a strong repressor, lambda C1, basically we inferred what was happening was that leaky expression of this repressor was repressing the reporter gene in the light and in the dark. And so though the rest of the circuit was probably behaving properly, we couldn't read it out. So we verified this by taking the edge detection circuitry out. So we just used the reporter plasmid only, and we showed that we could induce it with homoserine lactone, as we should be able to. And then when we threw the edge detector circuitry in, even in the light, when the repressor should have been inactivated, we couldn't induce it anymore with homoserine lactone. So it did look like the presence of this edge detector circuitry was limiting the ability to express any reporter. So we went back to a really nice trick developed in Ron Weiss's thesis. We actually used three ribosome binding sites that Ron Weiss used in his thesis to modify a gene circuit much like this, of differing strengths. So what we wanted to do was basically turn down the expression of this repressor and try to get it to a point where in the dark it was dominant, in the light it was actually permissive to gene expression. So we used this RBS2, which is relatively strong, and we saw no edge again. We used RBS1, which is very weak, and we saw no dynamic range. And then we tried RBS3, and we got lucky, and we projected the light-dark image again. And here's the photography strain for reference. So in the dark, they're on, in the light, they're off. In the edge detector with ribosome binding site 3, you can see in the dark, they're off. In the light, they're off, but at the edge, they're on. And this looks kind of wide. This isn't a full Petri dish. This is actually a 24-well tissue culture size plate. So this edge is only about 2 millimeters wide. So it's not as big or fat or ugly as it may look. I actually let this one grow for 2 days, so the edge became rather thick. If this one grew for about 20 hours, and you can see a thinner edge. This one also grew for about 20 hours, you can see a thinner edge. So what we want to do is actually, so you can't make a pretty outline of Drundi's face with this sort of fat, sloppy edge, right? So we want a really fine edge, really high resolution control. So what we want to do is, you'll notice there's some amount of background expression in the light away from the edge relative to the dark. So we want this to be totally off, this to be totally on and sharp, and that to be totally off as well. So you'll notice that, or I showed you before that the light repression of the two genes was incomplete. One of those genes is LuxI, which makes the activator. So in the light, these cells are probably making some amount of activator and capable of activating themselves to some level. So we want to poison LuxI in the light. So we can add an antisense RNA or a ribozyme to be expressed in the light to turn down their ability to auto-activate. Or we can mix in cells expressing IO, which is a homoserine lactone degrading protein, into the plate at some increasing concentrations to try to decrease background and tune the width of the edge. Or we can modify the pH because homoserine lactone activators actually destabilize at high pH. So any number of these things may sort of help increase the sort of contrast and decrease the width of that edge. So I'll pass it over to Aaron, who's going to talk about some advancements on the light system that we've taken this year.
Thank you. My name is Aaron. I'm from the University of Texas. First thing I'm going to show is a characterization of this part, which is BioBrick now, and it is the single plasmid compilation of both the phytochrome and chromophore that we'd previously tested in a two-plasmid system. And thanks to Natalie here at MIT for actually synthesizing it for us. What this data shows is this is the original two-plasmid system right here that most of our experiments have done, and this is the single-plasmid biobricked version. It has a different promoter for PCB, which is the phytochrome, and a different copy number. What we found out was the original two-plasmid system is a light repressed, shows repression in the light and induction in the dark. When we tested this single-plasmid system here, initially it is inverted, and this is not expected at all. It's kind of a big surprise, but we also found out through further testing that osmotic stress on the cell, you lose light responsivity, and this is due to the fact that it is a chimeric fusion with OMZ, which is an osmosensor, and there's lots of crosstalk pathways with that. We also can lose light response with a small osmotic stress with the two-plasmid system, but this still does not necessarily explain the inverted response that we see with the single-plasmid system. Another interesting thing with the single-plasmid system is that the background response, even in the inversion, is too high to do bacterial photography with. These are done with liquid assays with broad spectrum wavelengths. Another example of this is also, this is the two-plasmid system that we presented before. This is the single-plasmid system, which shows the inverted logic. This is actually, OMP-C is the promoter that we normally use. OMP-F is an orthogonal promoter, which should invert the system by itself, which you see right here. So we're also seeing the same inversion right here with the single-plasmid biobricked version. We've also done some experiments with multiple wavelengths. The phytochrome PCB normally has a conformational change at 659. And so we've been doing our experiments with our bandpass lenses at 640, which is pretty close. We're going to closely, you know, get to that. It also has an 704 conformation change that we had not previously tested. It had been theorized that the 704 conformation was similar to the dark conformation of the phytochrome. Therefore, what we did is we projected down a background of 640 nanometer light and a 735 nanometer band across that. This is what this image is right here. And it's hard to see right here, but you can see the induction with the 735 band. What this means is that with 735, it's actually a similar response to in the dark itself. This might be able to give increased induction in the dark if you augment your images with 735 wavelength. It's also very useful in single cell experiments. When you're doing single cell experiments under a microscope and you want to be able to induce a single cell, it's more difficult to project down a dark spot as opposed to projecting down using a laser to project down 735. And this is just a brief description of the 735 simultaneous two wavelength setup that we used. We used a lamp coming in perpendicular to our normal projection that would project down 640 to the background, and then a 735 image on top of that. This year's iGEM competition, we're in the initial testing planning phases of it, and the idea was a receptor regulation with OMP-C KIR. KIR is a methyl transferase which adds methyl residues to this chemoreceptor, basically desensitizing it. We chose KIR because it's the only thing without invasively messing up the chemotaxis system that you can overexpress and basically kill chemotaxis. This is interesting in that if you want to do small single cell experiments and basically kind of kill motility, this is a system that you can do that with. And it's applicable to small microscale fabrication experiments that Brian is going to talk about. Yeah.
So my name is Brian Kerr, and I work primarily in the laboratory of Jason Scheer. And what we're interested in is taking devices that, say, you all genetically engineer and integrating them in functional micro devices. And the technique that we use to do that involves multiphoton excitation, which very simply is a way to localize photochemistry in a highly specified three-dimensional spot. And so the photochemistry that we're interested in is photocrosslinking. And a typical experiment that we do to fabricate our objects involves using proteins. And so we use concentrated protein solutions to fabricate objects in three dimensions by using a focused laser beam. And we're interested in these types of biocompatible materials, and we've actually figured out ways to do this types of fabrication under conditions that are compatible with living cells. So you can see that this happens, this direct write process, in this particular movie, where it shows a microfabricated structure and a motile cell, this is an E. coli cell, actually interacting in real time. This is fabrication in real time, confining this particular cell, corralling it for a brief period, until it discovers a third dimension and sees that it can get out. So to add a couple more elements to this mix to make more complicated structures, I use a scan box to scan rectangular patterns and this mask plane in order to do more complicated structures. So in this case, I put a fly in the mask plane and was able to make basically a fly microfabricated canyon. So this material is actually bovine serum albumin, and this fly mask is actually defining the features of this canyon. So this is a very malleable way to ascribe particular small features into a microstructure. And I can get a reduction level dependent on the objective that I use, usually a 100x objective. So if you're thinking about designing some type of behavioral device for, you know, your organism of choice, you can do it with transparencies. Print them out on your office printer. So let's just print this out. Let's see what happens. And this is actually showing you fabrication of this particular device. This is about double time. And the key here is the removal of this mask. And the three-dimensional chemistry allows a roof to be drawn on the structure so that we can make this little micro house. And to test that, we'll throw in some E. coli cells, and here he goes, he's going up, and he gets stuck there, so we might have to go back to the drawing board with this particular design. These cells have only been engineered to swim straight, so they're just smooth swimming cells. But you can see how this would allow complicated arbitrary patterns quite easily, and these are easily prototyped. And so I am interested in trapping devices and circular behavioral devices. Here's a particular micro trap in the shape of Texas, so you can see a little bit of activity here in the Austin area. This is right after we won the national championship, so. So to show how cool this technique is, this is actually a two-dimensional or a three-dimensional two-story house fabricated with two masks. And to test it, I sent in some bacteria. They're on the ground floor. They're searching around. I'm going to focus up and see them enter this top chamber. So this is an actual micro house that has a second floor. And that's fairly cool. Towards more useful devices, I've shown you that we can do this fabrication under conditions that are biocompatible. So this is actually a house in which, and it's a very simple design, where I waited for a bacteria to come into the house and then photofabricated a plug closing in this bacteria. So this is a single cell, and watched it over time. And this cell, you know, I put media in, there's no bulk flow here, and this cell divided and, you know, divided and filled up this chamber. And so the technique is neat, but what's also remarkable is this type of material we're using. This material is important so that it's a diffusible material. It allows waste out and nutrients in, which is in contrast to other microfabricated materials such as PDMS. So this is just a look at the two-cell stage right before these cells split. So I've shown you that we can use these as traps. So what happens when you incubate these cells? They continue to divide in these stationary phases. Well, it's actually quite remarkable. They divide and they seem to find the wall of least resistance, which is usually the ceiling, and they form these rather large sort of protrusions, these Jiffy Pop looking structures. So here's a four-chamber device. We zoom in on it, and we can see this very highly invaginated structure, very thin material. So it's really remarkable to see how this material holds up under these types of stresses. You know, it's unclear the interaction right now between the cells and the material, but it's quite neat. And so here's just another example. This is one of the first traps I designed. You can see this thing extend up quite significantly above the height of the structure. So I'm going to finish up here by showing you that we can build architectures that will ascribe certain behaviors for the potential of maybe doing micromechanical work. So this is just a loopy structure. You can see the cells go in and tend to swim in this counterclockwise direction. So we can prototype that further. Maybe they'll swim in the other direction if we do sort of the mirror image of this structure. Turns out they do. And you know, why not just for fun, we'll put these two structures together with this interface. These cells want to do a figure eight. But you can see them bump into each other, and this is kind of fun. And I want to just sort of point out, in this particular movie, you can sort of see these cells that aren't moving, and they seem to be kind of susceptible to some type of hydrodynamic vortex that's maybe being created by these cells. And that appears to be the case. It appears to be that we could potentially harness this material. So. Here's cells swimming in this particular direction are spinning these emotile cells in the opposite direction. So this is a separation, but also shows that you could actually drive some type of device with cell motility. On the opposite end of that, this device was fabricated in order to keep cells in a particular position. And what you're going to watch here is that cells on the outside are still flapping their flagella and generating this internal vortex. So it shows again that their motors are sufficient to make these little hydrodynamic micro vortexes. So I think this is pretty exciting. There's obviously a lot of work to be done and a lot of potential here. And in the devices that you all create, you know, you can think about, you know, for instance, turning on or off one of these little micro pumps at will through some of the switches that you all engineer. So with that, I'd just like to say thanks. Well, that's certainly possible. I mean, I think it's possible. To design that particular device is going to take a feat of engineering. But I think these initial experiments prove that you might be able to, you know, generate an inductor with magnetic bacteria, you know, figure out some type of device like that.
Yeah. Is there an easy way you thought of to make sort of a one-way door for the houses that you were cutting off manually each time, so you just have a lot of them and each one of them to get?
I believe there is, and it's not something that I've been able to accomplish, but you could just think of some type of geometry like this where a cell is allowed to enter, it flaps open, and then it's not allowed to shut. Because I can fabricate things in three dimensions with such high resolution, I think that type of door is fairly easy to do, and I'll definitely want to try that.
How much interaction was there amongst the team members between your project and the first
company? So they obviously work on the genetic engineering aspects of what we've presented, and I'm actually working on more of a device, microfabricating devices. So as far as me inputting into their, you know, device fabrication, I don't have much input into that.
We had also talked a couple of years ago about doing single cell experiments, and I think that eventually led to us kind of getting together on this, at least somewhat. And that also affected our decision to do the 735 experiments, because at the time, they have the facilities to be able to do the single cell stuff. And the 735 experiments were kind of integral to be able to do those types of experiments.
And they're also working on, you know, like they said, chemotaxis or motility light sensors. And so it was from our discussions that we came up with ideas of trying to make a micro pump or a micro vortex. So that particular slide that you last saw was a direct result of our interactions.
But just to that point, we didn't yet on the wiki you described this light control chemotaxis as future work. We didn't really talk about that. Maybe you can tell us.
It's still in the initial planning phases. We kind of have focused on finishing up our original project.
But what's the idea? Maybe you can just give us some.
The original idea is to overexpress this methyl transferase ADR. When you do this, the chemoreceptor is desensitized, and thereby you are turning off chemotaxis, and actually the cell will go into a tumor state as opposed to the normal swim state. And that's a way that you would be able to, interacting with some of Brian's stuff, be able to turn on and off the vortexes or turn on and off cell motility.
With focused light.
With focused light.
Is there any reason to believe that wouldn't work based on what you've done so far?
No.
It might be slow. The light stock is extremely fast, so that would be limiting. But there are other tricks to make it much faster. You can use a lot of the same protein machinery we used in different configurations to actually get like millisecond changes in protein state.
Okay, thanks very much.